Hi everyone, this is Justin Chisholm welcoming you to our second Vendée Globe special episode. It might only have been 5 days since the 33 Vendée Globe skippers set off from Le Sable d'Olonne on their solo around the world adventure, but there's been plenty going on out on the wilds of the North Atlantic. So let's get going straight away. I'm going to bring in my expert co-host, Conrad Coleman, who's over in Lorient, France. Conrad, I've been glued to the tracker and to all the updates. How about you?
Yeah, very definitely. The tracker is something that's relatively new for me in the past few years because I've normally been out at sea generating storylines rather than watching other ones. But I tell you, I've been absolutely glued to the tracker, and I've been sort of putting together a list of the people that are having a few challenges out there. And I think, as you've seen, Justin, there have been a number of, small breakages and a few sort of consistent ones. So, Justin, can you sort of tell me what you've seen out there? But most notably, the sort of small bruises rather than big problems.
Yeah, it seems to me that it's hard to say this, isn't it, when we're sitting in front of our computers on a Zoom call, but it seems to have been a relatively easy start compared with some that we've seen before, where the boats have gone out into absolutely heinous conditions in the Bay of Biscay. This time they got away under sunny skies, and you know, yes, we've seen some fronts come over and a little bit of damage, but I think compared to other years, this hasn't been quite so brutal, has it?
Well, yeah, for sure. It's easy to say that with a cup of hot coffee in front of us and warm, dry socks. But to put some numbers on that, remember the ferocious edition from 2008, where on day four, again, sort of making your way out of the Bay of Biscay and into a cold front like the boats have just gone through. Three boats were dismasted on day four. Alex Thompson was out with a cracked hull after dancing off a wave on day six. And then the Butcher's Bill just got longer and longer and longer in 2008, and only half of the fleet finished. In 2012, it kicked off with a bang on day one. On the first night, Mark Nemo's fancy new titanium keel fell off, which was a bit of embarrassment to a sponsor who had made it. Day two, Quito had a collision with a fishing boat. Day three, Louis Burton had a collision with a fishing boat. Day five, Sam Davies dismasted going into a cold front as well. So that was 2012. But kind of like what we see now, 2016, the edition that I did, you had to wait until day 14 before you had your first retirement, which was first time the Bock after apparently hitting something. But then once he opened the ball, then it started to get underway with Vincent Ayoux hitting something as well with his keel on day 17. And Morgan Lagavière also, after hitting something, retired on day 19. So, you know, maybe this speaks to the fact that the sailors are more experienced, or their teams are getting the boats in a higher state of readiness this time around. Or just the conditions have been somewhat more clement.
So I think you're right, but Conrad, it's not been boring to watch. It's been quite adventure filled, hasn't it? Can you give us a little summary? I'm sure everybody who's listening to the podcast has probably been tuned in as well, but just give us a little précis of how the fleet is, what they've been facing on these first few days.
Yeah, well, it's been pretty classic in the sense that the North Atlantic in November is a pretty challenging and terrifying sometimes place to sail. The boats have gone through two cold fronts on their way out of Biscay, and the second cold front split the fleet in the way that they negotiated Cape Finisterre, the northwestern corner of Spain. We saw most of the foilers heading out west to try and get a jump on that cold front. The reason that you want to west is best, that you want to invest that way, is that as the system sweeps across the Atlantic heading eastwards, if you're the furthest west and the first boat to get into it, then you get the wind shift in front of everybody else, and then can dive south in the new breeze. However, one of the things that we've been seeing consistently is that all of the sailors have, particularly the faster boats, have been saying that they've been sailing with 2 feet firmly planted on the brake pedal. And that has allowed the fleet to come back together. And now, as we look into it, this 5 days in, we've got a bunch of Daggerboard boats. We'll talk about that in more detail later, in amongst these fancy new flying boats. So I think that even as the boats are now stepping it up with this slingshot of the tropical storm Theta, the first week has been marked by everybody taking things pretty slowly.
I think it's also worth pointing out that while we're talking about a relatively calm start to the whole thing, lighter winds don't necessarily mean less work for the skippers or more sleep. In fact, it seems to me from watching the videos that have come in that the skippers have had relatively no sleep at all, because they've had sail changes and they've had boats around them and shipping lanes. I mean, you've been there. What's it like getting away from Le Sable d'Olonne?
It's tough work. You know, Biscay is very challenging. It has a very difficult chop. They can be difficult to set your boat up for, and then you've got these fronts that roll over all the time. And so each time you go into a cold front, you're sailing. You reach into it and you go upwind into it. You tack in the middle of it, and we've been hearing about these sailors tacking in the middle of 45 to 50 knots, which is pretty challenging to keep both the sailor and the boat in one piece. And then you end up with these crossed seas where it's wind against waves, and it makes the boat jump and lurch in a very unpredictable and very dangerous manner. And as you say, we've had these sort of ridges of light wind in between the fronts, which has led to boats going from almost survival conditions of going upwind in 50 knots to then reaching and running in sort of 10 to 12. And you have to cycle through all of your sails to go from sailing upwind with your J3, the small jib, to running again with the big Jenica, which is 360 square meters of cloth that weighs 80 kilos. You've got to hoist 30 meters up in the air. These are big maneuvers to be doing. And I think that we've had a great insight into that by Clarice Clemel and Ben Populaire, who's been quite vulnerable in the way that she has talked about her first days of the race, saying that she is giving it everything that she's got, but the boat is taking more from her than she has to give. And so somebody who's been very well prepared, but is a rookie out there, is speaking in a manner that's a lot more frank than the veterans, and gives us a good idea of what it's actually like.
Now, there's some big news that we've got to talk about. It's the elephant in the room. One of the race favorites, Jeremy Bayou on Chiral, he's had to turn around and is heading back to Le Sable d'Olonne. It's an absolute shocker. I mean, this is a race headline of the highest order. There's been lots of chat about what happened. I got a little bit confused. There seemed to be rudder damage, and then there was some other torque damage. I know you've been looking at it. What can you tell us about what happened?
Yeah, well, it just goes to show how quickly things can spiral out of control. This is one of the most well-prepared boats in the fleet. It was the first of the new generation that was launched just before the Route du Rhum 2 years ago. And that was almost always his sort of cart, his card to play was reliability. He had the first of the new boats, he had the speed, and then he had the reliability, and he was lining up to smack that out of the park. And so what initially fails was a turning block for one of his jibs. And so to give you an idea about how this works, and I know it's tough on the podcast without visuals, but the sheet comes back from the sail through the trimming rings, that the 3D rings that allow you to trim the sail up or down or in or out or control the twist. And then instead of going directly onto a winch as you would on a standard cruising or racing yacht, and because these Amoka 60s are built like fortresses with their cockpits quite deep and their big verandas almost to keep the spray off, The sheets often go through sort of quite a tortured route back into the cockpit and onto the winch. And so it goes through several corners. And those corners are obviously under a lot of load with a turning block or pulley. It looks like the anchor point for one of those turning blocks failed under the load, which is given the age of the boat and the fact that it's one of the, again, the earliest ones to hit the water. It's really surprising to see this fail. Had it been on Quorum, who was launched earlier this year, I would have been less surprised. So anyway, you've got a fully loaded sheet under several tons of load, go ping, and that clearly created a lot of collateral damage. It appears that not only has the block failed, but the sheet, when it was released under tension, has crucially damaged the mainsail track bulkhead, which is a big structural piece, big bit of carbon. And then his day got worse, because when Jeremy was inside the boat looking to see whether there was damage inside, his boat struck an object at full speed and damaged the rudder. Now the rudders have a fuse in them and will kick up if they strike something at speed, which happened. The rudder did kick up, but it did still sustain some damage. And so now he's got a damaged rudder. He's got no spares on board because he has wagered everything on the fact that the kick up mechanism will preserve the rudder fin. He's got damage to a big structural component of the boat, and some of his sheets are out of action. He was still a little bit, as he said himself, in denial about the ultimate consequences of this. So he kept on sailing instead of doing a U-turn at that point, went through that cold front off Cape Finisterre, and then once he was in more clement conditions on the other side, started looking around. But going through that front, as I said earlier, means that you have to tack. So he tacked over and pulled on his new backstay, which he has said has been significantly damaged by all of the carbon shards and splinters left over from the first damage. So now he can no longer tighten his backstay. He can't keep the mast. And that was really the final straw. And so he's heading back. And he's due in tomorrow morning. He's going to have a rendezvous there with his team, and they'll look at options.
Now, Conrad, you know him pretty well, and you've also been in these difficult situations and know what it's like to have to make big decisions. But he's sailing back on his own. It's some 600 miles. He's from when he turned around back to Les Abdalon. He's all on his own. I know he can communicate with people, but he must be in his own head a lot now. What's he thinking? And can you, it's hard for you to tell us what he's thinking, but what do you think he's thinking, and what are his options when he does get back?
Well, first, technically, the restart rules mean that the start line off the Sabdalon is open for 10 days from the original start. So that means that if he gets in on Saturday morning, his team has got until Wednesday afternoon at 2:20 to restart. Otherwise, he has to scratch at that point. So I know a lot of the team. I know that they're back down in the Sardelon. They've been building components and getting new rigging set up so that he can turn around. But there's only so much that they can prepare in advance, because they can't do a full diagnostics when the boat is still at sea. As far as Jeremy himself is concerned, I know him relatively well. I've done a bunch of workouts with him, and he is one of the most competitive people that you or I will ever come across. I think that he would chew his own leg off before he would let anybody else beat him if he had any opportunity. But that's when he's at his finest. Remember, this is his fourth race. He didn't get past Brazil on his first two attempts, and that led to some people thinking that he was a little brittle mentally. But he has been doing a lot of work to overcome that. He had a brilliant race last time around and finished on the podium. But then we did see him very defeated in the video call that he did when he was sailing back. And so he made mention of the fact that he's been working on this for 4 years. The Von Le Globe has been living in his head, particularly because he's been chasing victory this time. And so to have all of that come tumbling down is absolutely brutal. You know, maybe on a lesser extent, I experienced that when I dismasted last time. But having, you know, had this race dominate my life for almost decades now for him is really tough. And then also I'd like to add, because he sort of dropped this bombshell on all of the French fans who heard that interview, is he said that his father had a stroke before the start of the race, a week before the start. So all of that to say that we don't know whether we're going to see Charles take the sea again. I obviously wish him well and his team well, we'll just have to see.
Yeah, it would be a real tragedy for him to be out of the race, but as you say, his whole reason for being there was winning and not just getting around. So you could understand if that mission has gone, that he perhaps wouldn't want to chase the fleet around the world. So as you say, we wish him well and good luck with that decision, and good luck to the team if they do decide to repair the boat. If they do, this has echoes of 2008, doesn't it? This has...
Yeah, very definitely.
Mitch Dez written all over it.
Michel Desjoyeaux, who was also a favourite to win the race in 2008, he had to turn back a couple of days into the race and then ended up restarting the week afterwards. The thing that pulls him out of the race then was that the 2008 generation of the boats carried a lot more water ballast than the current one. And his engine, which was his primary source of energy — we'll talk about energy on the boats later on in the podcast — but back in 2008, running an alternator on the engine was the primary way that you charge your batteries. And he had a leak in one of his ballast tanks that flooded the engine compartment and completely destroyed all possibility of running the boat. So he came back, he restarted behind everybody else, and then he slowly worked his way up through the fleet into the top 10, and then ultimately won the race with clear daylight between himself and Amel Lukliashu, who came second then. So, you know, it remains to be seen whether he restarts, and whether when he restarts the meteorological condition will allow him to take big chunks out of the fleet and get back into it. You know, I know that if anybody, if I was going to put a wager on anybody who could get back into it, it would be him, especially when he's pissed off.
Yeah, don't make him angry. It's the best. Shades of Ainsley or the Hulk, I'm not sure which. So, well, we'll be watching that one with bated breath, and I'm sure you'll be writing about that at some point in your column next week on the yachtracing.life website. Okay, so before we go back to the race, let's take one of our listener questions. We had a great question from Nicolas Christinet. I'm not sure where Nicolas is from, but he says, thanks very much for the very interesting podcast. Well, thank you, Nicolas, for that. Those kind words. And he asks, can you advise how electricity is generated on board the boats? I understand there are generators. Are they running on fuel? Are they permanently running, or just now and then? And would it not be possible to run only on solar and wind energy? That would make it even nicer. He's got I think that's a very, very good point. So over to you. This is a subject close to your heart, Conrad.
Yes, it certainly is. It's something that I've been working very hard on for the past few years. And in the last edition of the race, I was the first person to, not the first person to try, but the first person to succeed in going around the world without burning any fossil fuels. And to create a 100% renewable energy source on board, yes, you can have solar, and that was part of my portfolio of energy sources on board. But because these boats go really fast, and because water is really dense, the most efficient way of creating energy on board in a renewable way is through some form of hydrogenerator. Now, there are two systems that can do that. One is the pretty standard option, which is hanging off the back of most of the boats in the fleet, which is a Watt and C, that's the name of the company. Hydro generator, which is a little turbine that flicks down underneath the boat and spins away merrily. Well, it actually screeches, but can generate 10, 15, 20 watts. And it's certainly enough to run the boat on. And I would encourage you to go and check out Boris Herman's website, because he has a plethora of live data coming back in off the boat all the time. It's really interesting for you to go and geek out on. And one of the parameters that he has always displayed is which one of his hydro generators is producing energy and how much. So you can actually go and look at what that clean energy generation looks like. The problem with solar is that we have lots of cables, lots of sails on board the boat. And if you have a line of shadow going across a solar panel, then it dramatically reduces its output. And also, the boats are heading south now in the northern hemisphere winter, which means that the sun is predominantly coming from the south, and we're heading south with big sails up. And so actually, solar panels towards the back of the boat are largely in shade until you get to the southern hemisphere, and then they are largely in shade because the southern ocean is pretty cloudy. So actually, solar can certainly play an important role, but you need to have a hydro generator on board if you're going to go green, which is what I did. Instead of having the Watt and C system with a little turbine, I actually used a Ocean Vault electric motor, and where I had replaced the primary diesel engine on board the boat with an electric motor, and I was able to activate a regeneration mode on that, much like an electric car doing regen braking when it comes to a stop or rolls down a hill. But the vast majority of the boats have a standard system where they have a little bit of solar, maybe a Watt and C system hanging off the back as a backup, but the majority of the energy comes from the primary diesel engine on board the boat with an alternator. And I think that what Charlie Darlin, for example, is representative of the standard process, where you take 200 liters of diesel with you, and he'll run the engine for a couple of hours per day with a daily allowance of 2 to 3 liters per day. That will charge the batteries. And the way that this energy gets used on board the boat is running the systems on board. So they can be the autopilot primarily, that's pretty hungry, the instruments, the satellite communication systems that allow them to download the weather and for us to see their videos and photos. And then also the desalinator. You have to drink on board, and typically these athletes who are working pretty hard have a high consumption of electrolytes and drinking water. And so while the engine is running, they will turn on their desalinator and turn salt water into fresh water. So, you know, you thought Jesus was good for getting wine out of water. These Von der Globe sailors are getting fresh water out of diesel. So that's typically how it's used.
So they really are relying very heavily, aren't they, on all of these for all of their systems on board. If they lose their power generation, then they're in quite a lot of trouble.
Yeah, very definitely. You know, if you go back to 1969 with Robin Knox Johnson, and he had a ham radio set on board to communicate, but very, very little power consumption, because he was a lot more autonomous, both with his food, which came from cans instead of freeze-dried packages, and he carried all of the water that he drank for his 300 days of sailing. And here, if the boat goes into blackout, then you're sunk. You know, and there's no way of hand steering for a long period of time, because then you can't do anything else. And the boat's not really set up for that, because the pilot will drive for 95% of the time, probably. And there's no auxiliary steering system on board the boats that don't need a lot of power. And so these are incredibly high-tech boats with, you know, Wi-Fi networks on board, so that all of the instruments can talk to each other. and these incredibly high-powered but incredibly precise autopilots that allow these incredible speeds that we're seeing. But if you go blackout, then it's game over very quickly.
Yeah, I do worry about Alex and the inside of his boat looks like the space shuttle to me, and it just seems to be everything is electronic. He's looking at his sails on cameras, but if he goes black, if the whole boat goes black, that's going to be a pretty difficult boat to sail. But anyway, I don't want to jinx anything. Fingers crossed that's not what's going to happen. So Nicholas, I hope that answers your question. Thanks for sending it in. If other listeners do have questions, we're very keen to have them from you. You can send them to info@yachtracing.life. That's our email address. Or you can drop us a message on Facebook, or you can send us a message on Twitter, where the handle is @yachtracinglife. Any way you want to contact us, we'll be happy to take a question. So, Conrad, let's get back to the race. Right now, Alex Thompson is beginning to stretch his legs. But before we get into that and his superfoiling boat, a word, please, about Jean Le Cam, the 61-year-old skipper who I think everybody is cheering on. He's sailing a non-foiling boat. And he's been regularly leading, and I think he's in second place as we're recording this podcast on Friday morning.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough to say anything new about Jean because he's been around this world for so much time, and he's very, very well known and very, very well appreciated by everybody in the sailing world. I got to know him decently well during the Barcelona World Race that we both did in 2014-15. And that's when he started sailing the boat that he's on now. So he has done two full races around the world, Barcelona World Race and the Vendée Globe, already in this boat. He knows it like the back of his hand. He has a very small technical team, which means that he is very, very hands-on. So I know that he recabled the boat this winter and redid all the systems. And the fact that he knows this boat really well and has such incredible confidence in it is allowing him to push really hard. And, you know, he's a bit of the old man in the sea himself. And he has been doing this for decades. He's very at ease at sea. And so, you know, we've been hearing stories from the rookies about how they're burning themselves out and getting a bit scared about the weather. This man has seen it all. He has done it all. He's happy as a clam when the boat is ripping along.
Yeah, he did just before we came on to record this, I was watching the live show. Great, they're doing a great job with the daily live show. The English version is great, and he was interviewed on there in French with subtitles, and he's just so down to earth and so non-sporting celebrity, or, you know, it's just fantastic. It's not that he's humble, because I think he knows how good he is at this sport, but he's so matter of fact. And he said at one point, oh, you know, you can say whatever you like to the press and you say blah, 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 blah. But now we're here and we're sailing and this is when it counts. And yeah, I don't think he was referring
to... he's certainly making it count.
Yeah.
You know, it's just gone 5 days since the start of the race, and he is only 40 miles behind Alex Thompson on his fancy new boat that he's got. He is going slower, and he will be overtaken eventually by the newer boats. The boat right tucked in behind him is Quorum, and Quorum's going 4 knots faster in the same conditions. So, you know, admittedly, his grip on second place is going to be pretty short-lived. But I think that it speaks too of the fact that this has been such a challenging first week, and that the foilers have not been able to stretch their legs. We've got another rookie in there, Benjamin Dautrou, who is in seventh place on Alex's boat that he sailed in 2012. So I think it's proof that there are still these non-foiling boats or these older boats that are still in the mix. But as they attack the Theta, Tropical Storm Theta, and are getting a slingshot off that, and then I think it won't be long before they get distanced pretty severely.
Now, we're going to talk about Theta in just 1 second, but we said Alex has hit the front. It's not a great surprise to see him at the front of the fleet, but as we discussed earlier in the week, he was quite deep in the fleet for quite a long time. And then suddenly, with a click of the fingers, he just pops out in front. Now, it'd be easy to think, oh, that's just he has this super fast boat. But you've been studying it. You've been watching him quite carefully. And you say it's not all about the boat speed.
I think he'll probably take issue with you saying to click of the fingers. because he has been working really, really, really hard to get into the position that he is now. I think what made a crucial difference is that he has been sailing quite conservatively, as you said, early on. That has allowed him to get through mechanically unscathed. And so his boat is in good shape. But then the night before last, is when I saw a crucial difference in the way that he was sailing relative to his compatriots out there in the front of the fleet with Afi Villa, Charlie Dalin, Kevin Escoffier, and Tom Orion on Leaked Out. And they were initially on the same trajectory. And Alex, he said himself in an interview, he saw a band of stronger wind around that depression that they were skirting at that time. And he put in five more jibes than the boats around him. And so clearly he was positioning himself exactly where the band of pressure was. And he worked harder than the boats around him to get down there. And I think that that allowed him in the early hours of yesterday to be sailing a couple of knots faster. And that's allowed him to punch out a little bit and make the difference early on. Also, I think that he is now, as we record this, heading for the strongest breeze coming off the tropical storm Theta. And he's got confidence in his boat. He's got the confidence in himself to be quite punchy in the way that he's negotiating this depression. And he's now going to be unchaining that boat and letting it go fast. And so I think that if you go and look at the website, he's got a system called the Hub, where like Boris, he has live data streaming from his boat, but also live data streaming from himself, and it logs how much sleep he's been getting. And frankly, he has not been getting very much. Yeah. He's been working very hard. And I fully imagine that he's been digging a hole for himself now to try and make the difference and punch out early. And then once the conditions are more stable, he can rest up while the boat rockets away by itself.
Because this tropical storm Theta, let's talk about it now, this does present an opportunity for the front runners to make a jump on the rest of the fleet. And I think Alex in particular. Just talk a little bit about what Theta is, and also how will the front runners approach it? What's their route going to be, would you expect?
Sure. Well, like the dumpster fire that is 2020, the 2020 hurricane season has been record-breaking, both in its ferocity and also the number of storms. We've never had 29 named storms like we have this year. Theta is the latest of that. So it's a very intense storm that had its birth on the western side of the Atlantic, and is quite atypical in a sense because it was born in the tropics and has been heading much the relief of the Caribbean countries and Florida, as they say, safely out to sea. if you look at sadly, I don't think they think about all of the sailors out there that are going to get walloped by it. So it's a very atypical system that we see here. So it's very relatively fast moving in its west-east transition across the Atlantic. It's very compact. It's very intense. There's sort of 35 knots sustained, probably gusting 45, 50 in there. And it is thankfully coming towards the end of its life as it approaches the European continent. And so the first boats, the fast foilers and the tip of the fleet are getting a really good slingshot. So this is a strategic godsend for them, which will allow them to continue to stretch out from the boats behind. And then as Theta continues to head towards Madeira and then finally on up towards the Spanish coast, then it will fill, as we say. It becomes less of a depression, less strong, which in many ways, will make life easier for the boats behind. They won't get as strong a wind, but equally they won't get the opportunity to get this epic slingshot down to the south as well. So this is yet another example of how in sailing, it's often the case where the rich get richer, and the guys at front can sort of thread the needle between the strong winds and the safety further out west, where Charlie and Thomas are. But it's going to really set them up for the miles to come. And if I can just continue on, how this is going to this is again an atypical situation, because normally the fleet would be over by Madeira and sort of scratching their heads about how they're going to get through the Canaries. But because these are represented such as a complex, dangerous system, everybody went far out west early on, which is going to actually give them a pretty easy run down to the equator and the doldrums, because normally it's a real struggle to sail deeper angles under spinnaker typically in this stretch of the course of the race. Whereas being so far west is going to allow the boats to sail hotter, faster, easier angles. So actually the trade winds are going to be fast and relatively easy, at least for the front of the fleet. But going into early next week, the typical Azores High will start to reposition itself in the middle of the Atlantic, and it will extend a ridge of high pressure across to another high pressure zone off the coast of Spain. And that's a problem again for those at the back of the fleet, because that will close the door heading south, because that ridge of high pressure comes with light winds, and I think that the leaders will escape, and those trailing will get stuck in the lighter winds.
So busy time, worrying time. The sailors have had no sleep so far. Doesn't sound like they're going to get an awful lot of sleep till they've got theta in the rearview mirror. Don't think they even have those on these boats. It's going to be interesting once the boats are into the trade winds. They may get some chance to sleep, perhaps. But the foilers should start to stretch their legs at that point, shouldn't they?
Yes, very definitely. That's when we're going to see them take a foot off the brake pedal, and we'll see them stretch their legs, that's for sure.
So that's...
they'll be sailing hotter angles or more reachy angles rather than runny angles because of their position west. And so we'll see them probably break records for that part of the descent further south.
Well, it's been a fascinating first week, Conrad. It looks like it's going to be a fascinating second week as well, and so on and so on. Thanks a million for today. I know we'll be speaking in the week. I'm looking forward to your column, as I know a lot of other people are, during the week, probably Wednesday. And we will reconvene this time next week for another podcast special Vendée Globe edition. But for now, Conrad Coleman, thanks a million.
Sounds good. See you there.